Federal Senate State Affairs together, 13 March. It's about 2 minutes after the hour. We have present Senator Giesel, Senator Coghill, myself, Chair Dyson. I suspect Senator Wilkowski will be along. We have no excuse for Senator Stedman. We got several items of business here. The first, the confirmation of the parole board. Then SB 116, service of citations. SGR 26, Pledge of Allegiance. I expect to get through all three of these items, perhaps with dispatch. First item that we have up is the confirmation to the parole board. Lonzo Henderson. Lonzo, can you hear us?
I'm here, sir.
You don't need to call me, sir, but maybe you. We should call you, sir. I appreciate your experience. I understand that this is a reappointment. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct, Chairman.
All right. I would appreciate if you'd explain to us a little bit about what the parole board does, what the mission is, and then a little bit how you approach that.
Thank you, Senator Dyson, Chair Dyson, for the privilege to appear before the board and Vice Chair Giesel and members that are present. The Alaska Board of Parole has authority under Title 33, which gives us authority by the governing body there in Juneau to we are releasing authority for individuals who have been sentenced by the courts to a period of incarceration, and if they after they have served a portion of their term, unless the courts have deemed them inappropriate for applying for parole, they can apply for parole. And the parole board, we take a look at the individual application in conjunction with recommendations from the institutional probation parole officer staff and other treatment providers. And basically, we take a look at how the person has, what they have done in the institution to what we term as to make themselves more viable for rehabilitation and reentry into a society, because part of the sentencing criteria that the courts use is isolation, deterrence, and reaffirmation of societal norms. The parole board comes in at the prong where it's the reaffirmation of societal norms, where people have completed programs, they are doing well, and they have a release plan that's going to be conducive to their rehabilitation to reenter society.
And I understand. And
I'm not sure if I answered your question totally.
You did fine. And I assume that a part of that is that you evaluate on some level the potential risk to public safety, i.e. they're reoffending.
Yes. Actually, the parole board, the parole board members have just received training on the LSIR, which is the level of inventory revised. And that's a instrument that the department is using statewide, and the parole board will be utilizing that tool, as well as there's a static 99 for sex offenders and some other instruments that are used for sex offenders. And the parole board will be looking at the offender release plan, and we will be tailoring conditions that what we call criminogenic needs, that if it's a simplistic process, if a person is in custody and has a history of drug substance abuse, we want to ensure that the release plan entails completing treatment in custody if time allows, and completion of aftercare component in the community, and tailoring those conditions to accommodate what the person actually needs to address. And the focus for the overall the criminal justice system now is to reduce the amount of conditions but make them, tailor them to the individual's needs, so that we don't have to, there's some standard conditions that everyone will have, but we need to tailor conditions to individual needs so that we are ensuring that we are focusing on the criminogenic needs that and things that they will need to address to be productive members of society.
Yeah, when I poked around in your responsibilities a decade or two ago, I was looking to find out if there was a process whereby where a released felon who had good behavior, in this case 20 years, could have rights restored. And as I remember, that took a recommendation from you all and then perhaps the governor's approval or something. Can you refresh my memory on that?
I believe once they have completed their supervision, they can ask to have their rights restored. And we do have a couple of mechanisms where people that are individuals that are released onto supervision, if they're doing well, they can come come back before the board and ask to be released early. If they typically it has to be 2 years or more of a good supervision, but they can come back and ask to have their to be released and to have the, and at that point I believe they can actually have their rights reinstated. I think you're referring to voting rights. If
certainly, and the rights to have a firearm or other things,
as all the members are aware, there's a distinction between state law and federal law, and so that, and I think that some of those issues come about, but I think part of what, it depends upon what, and there's a, when the form is filled in, is submitted to for having their rights restored, it depends upon what the crime is, so there's a lot of details that go into what the crime was, what whether the crime involved a weapon, those kind of things, as to whether the person can have their total rights reinstated.
Yeah, and that's utterly reasonable, but does the board make the decision, or do you make a recommendation that goes up line to the governor on the restoration?
You know, I think you may be referring to the clemency process, which is a little different from the probate, from the parole process.
Yeah, okay.
Because that's where people can, and there is a, the governor's working with the committee right now to set up a process to reinstitute the clemency process, and that we have staff that are working with the governor's office that where people can apply to have because there are certain professions that they have to have those kind of privileges reinstated in order to actually be involved in those kind of professions, and I believe that's maybe what you're referring to.
Sure. How much time does this responsibility require of you?
Actually, the way the new process, as I understand it, we have staff in the parole office that are working with, in conjunction with the governor's staff, to set up the process. And the board is actually not directly involved with that. That's a separate process that we have staff person in the. And our executive director, Jeff Edwards, and Taryn Link, who is actually working with the staff. To move that process along with the governor's approval to have it in place, and that they are still in the discussion process, so I'm not sure when that's going to be implemented, but I know that it's been ongoing in a discussion process.
Yeah, my question was how much time of your time does this job require of you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I thought you were referring to the clemency piece. The board's time as the this is a part-time as all members probably are aware, this is a part-time board with full-time responsibilities. We have hearings monthly. This week is a hearing week for us. We started in Fairbanks on Monday, and we are having hearings here in Anchorage, and then I have prelim hearings every Thursday. So it's a part-time position, but I think the The information on the website actually says, I think, about 150, 180 days that we are actually allotted for our honorarium for the position. But with the board's chair position, that of course there are a lot of things that have to happen that are outside of that.
All right, thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee?
Nope. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your service. Is there anything else you'd like to say to us?
Just to give you a quick brief overview of what the board has done in the past couple of years as I've been board chair. We have a consultant that we're working with through the National Resource Center, which is contracted through the National Institute of Corrections, and we are looking at updating the board's policies, updating the regulations, of course, in conjunction with the governor's initiative. And we have we've developed a mission statement for the board, which is preparing offenders for success. That was out of the first meeting that we had with our consultant, because we're looking at enhancing and improving the process for people to be able to apply for parole, to come before the board, and to be granted discretionary parole. And we've revised the form to make it easier for individuals to actually fill out the form, because as our consultant took a look at the form and said, well, you know, there are some issues with the readability of the form. So we are doing some of those things to improve the overall success rate for people coming up for parole.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the privilege to appear before the committee.
All right. Any objection to moving this?
Nope.
All right. So in accordance with Alaska Statute 39.05.080, the State Affairs Committee reviewed the following recommends appointment be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. For a reappointment to the State Board of Parole, Lorenzo Henderson, and this did not reflect intent or commitment of any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation individual during any further sessions. All right, we'll stand at ease for a moment while we get to sign the document. Senator Egan? We have before us, we will accept as our working document the committee substitute for Senate Bill 116, that's the 28-LS0826/C version. Is that your wish?
Yes.
Senator Egan? All right. Please identify yourselves for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Dennis Egan. I represent District P, includes Juneau. Mr. Chair, it's just another simple bill like last week. Sorry. But I appreciate you hearing the bill, and with me is Jesse Keel of my staff. Senate Bill 116 corrects an unintended consequence of a good bill we passed in 2010. This past March, the courts implemented that law, and it stopped law enforcement from leaving a ticket under the windshield wiper of a car, as an example. To keep enforcing local laws, many municipalities went to civil violations for just a minor offense, and that has its own problems, and it wasn't available to state law enforcement at all. This bill lets law enforcement go back to where it was this time last year. A parking ticket could go under your windshield wiper. And Jesse Keel, who's very knowledgeable on the bill, who happens to be on the General Assembly, and Juneau and Anchorage and Fairbanks. Municipalities that write tickets are affected. And Jesse can further present the bill.
Jesse.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Egan. The 2013 court rule that was adopted in April had the effect of stopping the court system from processing any citation that an officer did not personally serve, and they defined that carefully to in effect mean face-to-face, on the person charged with the offense. That, as the Senator said, is a result of a 2010 bill. And in reviewing the minutes of all the hearings on that 2010 bill, I can inform the committee that parking tickets never came up. The discussion was about moving violations, was about minor consuming, was about more serious infractions of the law. Those municipalities that had not chosen for their own reasons to make things like parking tickets civil violations then had to do so in order to keep enforcing their local laws for minor minor incidents, minor infractions. That choice, while it let the law be enforced, has two disadvantages, Mr. Chairman. The first is that with a civil citation, you don't get, if you need to fight the citation, if you don't believe it was fair, you don't get to go in front of a judge or a magistrate in the Alaska court system, a disinterested third party. You get to go to City Hall to fight City Hall. And while I can personally vouch for Juneau's deputy city manager who serves as our hearing officer, I know that there are many Alaskans who do not believe they can get a fair shake from City Hall when City Hall wrote the ticket and gets the revenue. They do believe, by and large, that a judge or a magistrate in the Alaska court system will give them a fair and honest hearing. The second significant disadvantage is to the municipalities. With citations that are written as the lowest possible level of criminal offense, in the rare case of the scofflaw who just throws it away, doesn't contest it, doesn't pay it, they're out of here, they don't care. Those citations can be defaulted against the offender's permanent fund dividend, for instance. However, with a civil citation, that process doesn't work. By and large, what has to happen is you have to build up enough of those that it's worth the filing fees to go sue, get a judgment, execute the judgment. It's a cumbersome process, and it adds time, expense, and difficulty to local law enforcement. I should clarify, Mr. Chairman, that this bill doesn't force any municipality that chose to take their violations process there, especially parking civil, to change that. I know that the municipality of Anchorage made that decision, and this bill leaves that decision between the municipality of Anchorage and its voters. To briefly discuss the limitations in the committee substitute, or rather the new changes in the committee substitute, Mr. Chairman, on page 1, line 7, it simply corrects what I believe is a typographical error in existing law that required both a peace officer and someone else authorized by law, code enforcement officer, municipal law, an animal officer, to issue the citations. This would say either or. Whoever wrote the citation must follow the rules. At page 2, lines 7 and 8, Mr. Chairman, this new subsection defines the limits on a citation that can be either left on personal property or served according to the civil rules. And the change in this CS would require that to be would limit that to offenses that are punishable by a fine of $500 or less. There are infractions that add points to your driver's license. There are municipal infractions that could carry a $1,000 fine. Don't leak oil in the Homer Boat Harbor, Mr. Chairman. In the sponsor's estimation, those penalties rise to another level. They require more due process than a normal ticket would that could be mailed to someone, return receipt requested, or left on the personal property or the real property. And then, importantly, to leaving on property, also on page 2 at line 10, the citation would have to be left in a conspicuous place. If Juneau's community service officers left a ticket for breaking our garbage laws and creating a bear attraction nuisance. You can't leave the ticket in the garbage can. That would not be okay. So the conspicuous place requirement is meant to just make very clear that people need to know they got a ticket. Mr. Chairman, those are the only changes in the CS. To briefly describe the other portions of that of the bill, I think it's worth knowing what the rest of the limits are. So the only citations that could be served on a person other than face-to-face handing it to you by the issuing officer would be those for infractions or violations. Misdemeanors, something that might carry a term of imprisonment, cannot be served this way. They have to be face-to-face. Minor consuming is the reference you see there to Title IV of the Alaska statutes. That's neither a misdemeanor nor a violation, Mr. Chairman. In the sponsor's judgment, if the police break up a party where kids are drinking, they need to hand the kids a citation. That's just appropriate. And then no offenses involving a moving motor vehicle. Again, Mr. Chairman, that's a situation where you, moving violations add points to a license. You need a license to get to work in most cases. That's something where an officer who stops you needs to give you the ticket in person, not mail it later. Mr. Chairman, that's the heart and soul of the bill. We'd be happy to take any questions. I know there are some folks who'd also like to address the committee.
Yeah. Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Just one question.
Senator Cogman.
The court rule then was made after the statute was passed under personally served?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer Senator Coghill's question, the 2010 bill dealt with a uniform statewide process for citations. It required that citations be personally served. The Alaska court system, in implementing that citation or that law in 2013, made clear that personally served would have to mean handed to you face-to-face. I have here I believe I included with the committee's documents the exact language of the rule, but that's the impact.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Lieutenant Rodney Dial, State Troopers, is on the line to answer questions if we have any. Rodney, I sure appreciate your faithfulness. You've got to have the worst job in the world. I hope you get hazardous duty pay. Scott Bloom is in Kenai. Can you hear us, Scott?
I can, Chairman Dyson. Thank you. Chairman Dyson, Vice Chair Giesel, Senator Coghill, my name is Scott Bloom. I'm the city attorney for the city of Kenai. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I ask that you support Senate Bill 116, sponsored by Senator Egan, as amended. The issues addressed by the bill are important to the city of Kenai for three main reasons. The first is public safety. On peak days in July, the city commonly has 10 to 12,000 visitors, and on our busiest day last year, we estimate we had 15,000. Our local streets, including residential streets and parking areas, are inundated. As word got out that the city can't issue parking citations, people tend to ignore restrictions, blocking driveways, fire lanes, and emergency access. Being able to enforce parking regulations without requiring personal service would alleviate a large portion of this problem. Last year, during the DIPNET season in July, we issued 12 citations. The prior year, in 2013, we issued 116. So the inability to leave a citation on a vehicle or other personal property greatly impeded our ability to enforce local regulations. The second reason is the strain on municipal resources. Enforcing parking as it currently exists under the law strains our municipal resources. Without the ability to leave parking tickets, our limited police force must either try and track down drivers and personally serve them, boot the vehicles, or tow them. This takes time and manpower, as a relatively small municipality is as difficult at best for us to set up an alternative administrative system to issue citations. Unlike Anchorage or Fairbanks with the economics to support a separate parking authority, this is not a practical solution for our city. The third reason that I ask for you to support Senate Bill 116 is because I believe it will reduce the cost for both the city and public related to parking. If the city must provide an administrative process, it will cost the city time and money, which will be passed on to the public through increased citation amounts. Further, the alternatives of immobilizing vehicles or towing them is exponentially more expensive and burdensome on all parties. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Other questions? There are none. I suspect all four of the elected officials here were on the job when we passed this bill that messed your life up. And on behalf of my colleagues, we apologize. And I think we appreciate that Senator Egan is solving this unintended problem. Is there anyone here in the room that wants to testify? Sir, please come forward.
Good morning. My name is Matt Musselwhite. I'm the Director of Animal Control and Protection here in Juneau, and I'm here today to show my support for SB 116. Since the implementation of the personal service requirement in April of 2013, my department has experienced a 48% reduction in issued minor offense citations. This requirement has also generated a considerable increase in our man hours required per case. At times, an officer may need to visit a residence five or six times in order to personally serve a $25 citation. The implementation of the personal service rule has also had a much larger consequence than just increased effort and loss of citation revenue. Mandatory court appearance citations that we issue for dangerous dog owners may go unissued simply because the owner refuses to answer their door. It is hard to tell a victim of a dog attack that I cannot enforce the laws without the violator's cooperation. The ability to leave a citation on the door of the residence or by certified mail for a minor offense allows my officers to devote more time and resources investigating more serious issues of animal cruelty, abuse, and neglect. This bill will provide law enforcement with the tools to do their job efficiently. I urge your support of this legislation. Thank you, and I can answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Thank you, and thank you for the job you do.
Thank you.
All set.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move from committee CS for Senate Bill number 116, version 28, LS0826C, with that's C Charlie, with zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 116 is moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Take up Senate Joint Resolution number 26 by Senator Coghill. Reneva, please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. We're here today to look at Senate Joint Resolution 26, which is a resolution recognizing June 14, 2014 as the 60th anniversary of the first recital of the United States Pledge of Allegiance with the words, "Under God." In the last year, 39 other states have passed resolutions recognizing February 4th, 2014 as the 60th anniversary of the introduction of House Joint Resolution 243, which is the resolution that was signed by President Eisenhower and included "Under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. It is true that the original pledge was written by a minister in 1892, and the pledge was an allegiance to, quote, "my flag." And it was his hope that it would be used by all nations to recognize their countries. But in 1923, the words, "the flag of the United States," was added to the pledge to make it more personal to people, pledging allegiance to the United States. And that change was made at the National Flag Conference under the leadership of the American Legion and the Daughters of the American Revolution. It was not until 1954 that Congress incorporated what was viewed as the missing link to the Pledge of Allegiance. And this missing link was recognized by Homer Ferguson when he heard a sermon in church that quoted the Gettysburg Address when Lincoln referred to a nation under God. So he introduced Senate Joint Resolution 26, and it was passed and signed by President Eisenhower on June 14th in 1954. So this would be the 60th anniversary of the signing, and then right after the signing, the group recited the Pledge of Allegiance using the words "under God." What I wanted to point out was that the Pledge of Allegiance is not a mundane verse that we recite because we learned it in school, and we recited it every day in school. To me, the Pledge of Allegiance reminds us that we live in a country that doesn't persecute us because we do pledge to preserve a God-given inherent right in this country, and people fought for that right. It reminds me that we are a government of 50 individual states who are united as a nation of free people. It reminds us that this flag, Old Glory, has been carried through battlefields and that blood has been shed by millions of people to protect the freedom that we have to speak our minds and to disagree with each other without the threat of retaliation. It reminds us that people from all over the world come to this country at great risk to live the American dream. And when I stand in the gallery in the Senate chambers and recite the Pledge of Allegiance with a room full of citizens and senators, what I hear is a group of Americans united, indivisible, in preserving this republic and the God-given rights our forefathers strive to preserve. This resolution is yet one reminder that we are Americans united as one nation under God. And I wanted to I had Josh pass out the sheet of paper that I transcribed last night from a video of a skit that Red Skelton did when I was about 10 years old. And he explained that they were doing the Pledge of Allegiance in school one day, and the teacher thought that they seemed to be a little bit bored, so he wanted to explain the Pledge of Allegiance. And I think all of us here are of an age that we remember that video. But right now, the Massachusetts Supreme Court is reviewing a case that was argued in September of last year that challenges the use of the words "under God." That decision is due any day now. But the text of this pledge that the teacher gave was given before "under God" was used. And Red Skelton, in his skit, recited it, and then he said afterwards, "Since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country, and two words have been added to the Pledge of Allegiance, under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that this is a prayer and be eliminated from school?" So I think he saw into the future what we're facing. And this resolution is Senator Coghill's way of bringing to light just how important the Pledge of Allegiance is and recognizing its significance.
Senator Coghill.
Three things I'd like to bring to the attention. And first of all, I think Reneva, hard act to follow, right? This came to our attention probably too late to get to a February 10 date. Which would have been probably the preference because many states have got February 10 as the date to commemorate, but it was first recited in June 14. So we decided we would follow on with that. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could just share with you one of the things that the Massachusetts and other courts are going to have to deal with, and in the state of Alaska is, and I'd like to read just the Statehood Act a little bit, if you don't mind. The article, Section 3 of the Statehood Act says, the Constitution of the State of Alaska shall always be Republican in form and shall not be repugnant to the Constitution of the United States and the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And certainly the pledge is a reminder to us that we're a republic, which many kids still today struggle with the difference between a republic and a democracy, direct democracy. And yet this is a constant reminder of that republic. But the Declaration of Independence also is based on some principles that I thought I had here. Thanks to Reneva, I have here. I had it in my pocket somewhere. The Declaration of Independence, as you well know, is dedicated to these principles that all men are created equal, but they're endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. And then at the very end of the Declaration of Independence, they pledge their lives and their honor, their sacred honor, but with reliance on divine providence, if you'll remember correctly. And then we had a jurist that I'd like to just read a portion. Ever heard of a man named Learned Hand? He was probably one of the most often quoted jurists in America. Never a Supreme Court justice, but probably quoted by the Supreme Court more than any other judge. He said in a speech in 1944, just prior to this under God being put in here, he says, what do we mean when we say that we first seek liberty? I often wonder whether we do not rest our hopes too much upon constitutions, upon laws and courts. These are false hopes. Believe me, these are false hopes. Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, law, or court can save it. No constitution, law, or court can even do much to help it. While it lies there, it needs no constitution, law, or court to save it. And what is this liberty which must lie in the hearts of men and women? It is not the ruthless, the unbridled will. It is not the freedom to do as one likes. That is the denial of liberty and leads straight to its overthrow. A society which men recognize no check upon their freedom soon becomes a society where freedom is the possession of only a savage few, as we have learned to our sorrow. And he goes on to quote that it really resides in our recognition that we are a nation of faith. And so he says here, and I'm going to just quote one more section. The spirit of liberty is a spirit which weighs their interest alongside its own without bias. The spirit of liberty remembers that not even a sparrow falls to earth unheeded. The spirit of liberty is a spirit of him who near 2,000 years ago taught mankind that lesson it never learned, but is quite never forgotten. And so that was a jurist, and I just wanted to remind us of a little bit of the history of those who have thought deeply and long about our heritage. And certainly this pledge is just a constant reminder that makes us have to reach back and maybe daily remind ourselves, and certainly we do when we start our sessions. This will be one way of people to commemorate it in our midsummer, shortly after our Day of Independence.
Thank you. Questions or comments from the committee? Anyone in the audience or online want to testify? All right. Chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move from committee Senate Joint Resolution 26, version 28LS1268N, November, with zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Any objection? Seeing none, the bill passes. Before we adjourn, I want to tell everybody we once again have a great team here. Joshua Banks, who's the committee chair, aide, and Chris and Shane, who serve us flawlessly. Great distinction. And thank you all.